Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
We have to talk about that man, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, don't we? Stupid or naive, it has always been my dream. That's what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said during an interview with a Norwegian TV channel earlier this month. Well, he was living the dream as interim manager, and now he's had his dream completed with a 3-year contract to manage Manchester United. Probably pretty surreal for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I would think, given that his previous Premier League experience amounted to, well, a couple of months managing relegation-doomed Cardiff. Just think back, actually. You go back 5 years, for example, to the day, which takes us into the middle of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's reign. He was actually sitting down the day before a real six-pointer against West Brom, Pepe Mel's West Brom at the Hawthorns. He just lost 6-3 to Liverpool. Luis Suarez just scored a hat-trick. What a year it was. He'd yet to record an away win in his 3 months at Cardiff, and they were pretty much starting to come to terms with near-certain relegation. Gareth Southgate, meanwhile, just for a bit of context, he had for the most part disappeared 5 years ago. After a slightly harsh sacking at Middlesbrough, they got relegated and he kept the job. They were flying high in the Championship and then he got sacked and he got picked up by the FA. Did a few different jobs. Ended up as under-21 coach. I don't think anyone expected very much from him, did they? And by the time we reached March 2014, 5 years ago to the day, he'd won 7 of his eight games in the under-21 Euro qualifiers. But he wasn't getting a lot of credit for the job. I was sort of leafing back through the archives. The BBC report for the last game, if you like, the 1-0 win over Wales, put them through into the European Championship, only mentions his name once. Who would have thought, 5 years later, these two men would have the biggest jobs in English football? Southgate, by the way, actually, just to be dragged onto a tangent briefly, even in the newspapers, who usually happen to interview almost anyone in the England setup, whether it be the kit man or the cleaner, there were very few words from Southgate in the papers that week. The one feature interview I could find with him almost used Southgate as a crutch with which to prop up a personality piece on Brendan Rodgers, then, of course, leading Liverpool towards an ultimately failing Premier League title bid. You can actually see plenty of the wisdom which we sort of know now from the England boss, even if the Mail on Sunday piece rather skates over it. He said about Raheem Sterling, "I played in San Etienne the night Michael Owen announced himself to the world, and particularly for attacking players, age is not a barrier. Very often, the innocence of youth is a positive. You don't think about reputations or history." How prescient those words were from Gareth Southgate. That's 5 years ago, when he was still relatively new as an under-21 boss. He only had a couple of years managerial experience. And he was talking about how youth shouldn't be a barrier. And that's something we've seen from both Southgate and Solskjaer. He went on to say, "England players are capable of being successful at the top level. We've seen a better technical product emerge from our academies over the past few years, and we have exciting players in every age group. A big challenge is not to reward them too early." I think that Southgate and Solskjaer are cut from the same cloth in that sense. They are both men who believe in the power of youth, in the fearlessness of youth, and how they don't get overwhelmed by reputations or history. And both England and Manchester United have seen players get overwhelmed by the enormity of the teams that they're playing for. It would be very easy to think that that could happen. In the same time period as Southgate was doing that interview, Solskjaer, of course, was Cardiff boss. He was too worried about the fitness of Craig Bellamy, who was desperately trying to get him back to fitness, who's hoping United might be able to do him some favours in clashes with relegation rivals. And I was interested to read some quotes from a chap called Kevin Theophile Catherine. Now, his somewhat insignificant career has led him to Dynamo Zagreb these days, but he said something I thought was very interesting about Solskjaer's management, even 5 years ago. He said, "We had to work hard to the very last kick of the match, and he drummed that into us. It was funny when he arrived and introduced himself, as he did not need any introducing. We all knew who he was. He commanded our respect right away. He makes us work hard and focus on passing and technical skills. It's good because it's leading us somewhere." Doesn't that sound familiar? Doesn't that sound like what Manchester United players are now saying about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer? That he's giving them some direction. He's giving them a bit of freedom in training and even on the pitch. He had an advantage, I admit, which is that he came in as an interim boss after Mourinho. He kind of had nothing to lose. But you know what? He's done an outstanding job. And so many of the former players who had been toxic in their criticism of the likes of Van Gaal, Mourinho, Scholes, Rio Ferdinand, Gary Neville, they are now turning and saying, you know what, Solskjaer's done a good job. Have a listen to Andy Cole and what he had to say, actually before the announcement.
I don't think there could have been many managers that have gone in and started just as well as he started and got the results that he's got. The way he started his Manchester United managerial career, he's been very, very special.
That's Andy Cole speaking to Sky Sports News there. Very, very special. And you can't argue with it, really, when you look at it. 14 wins, 2 draws and 3 losses. There was a point, wasn't there? There was a sort of decision point for United when they lost at home to PSG. They really hadn't been tested much other than that trip to Tottenham. And frankly, they were outplayed by PSG. And I think that will have worried it. I mean, that was what got rid of Mourinho in the end, by the way, was when they got utterly outplayed by Liverpool. Completely so. And that was really the last nail in the coffin. You can stomach a lot of things as a chief exec, but getting completely pants down, smashed by your rivals is not something you can stomach. And I'm sure that after that first defeat to PSG, everyone in the United boardroom would have gone, well, let's see. This is what we're going to have to find out about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Of course, we all know the rest. United became the first team in Champions League history to come back from losing 2-0 at home to get through to the next stage in the second leg. A completely brilliant performance. Of course, there was that win at Chelsea as well. They were helped by the fact that Tottenham lost at Burnley the same weekend they drew with Liverpool with about 8 men. There were some remarkable results in there. And I think that they will be the ones that convince them. Of course, beating the small teams, you have to do. You always have to do that. And the good atmosphere around the squad is important. But it was those big games, the ones which Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the striker, always seemed to turn up late in the day. Well, it's not late in the day now. United have pulled the trigger early and they've given him the permanent job.
This is Love Sport.
The modern role of a first team coach is to be a man manager, first of all. Remember that in football, you've got the chief exec and the board, and they do a lot of the business decisions. You've got the players, and they're sort of the products, the worker bees, if you like. They're important, it's what the world sees, but they're not the most senior people in the club. What the manager has to do is create a sort of middle management role for them. Protect the players from the board, look after them, make sure they're happy, but also try and get the best out of them, while also dealing with the demands of that Manchester United board. We know they can be very, very demanding. And what Solskjaer's done has actually been pretty remarkable when you look at what he's achieved in a short space of time. And of course, it's earned him the full-time job. Now, what does Andy Ritchie think about this? A man who himself has worn the prestigious shirt of Manchester United. Andy, is this the right time to do the right thing?
I think so, James, yeah. I think there's a lot of people that wanted it. I certainly did. I think he's done a fantastic job. 32 points out of 39, you can't say better than that. And in the quarterfinals of the Champions League, having beaten PSG, which I think a lot of people thought they wouldn't manage to do that. So I think it's the right time. It gives him a bit more security, and it also gives him time to think what he wants to do in the summer in terms of bringing people in.
Do you think that's why they've made this decision now? Because they very easily could have done. No one's going to pinch Solskjaer off their toes and he wouldn't go anyway. They could have waited until June, you know, when all the football's out the way, and said, right, Ollie, let's sort this contract out. Do you think it is a matter of wanting to start planning forward now?
I think so, James, because really, when you think about the agents and what they have to go through, the procedures to get people set up maybe for moving to Manchester United, I think you need more time. Yeah, I'm sure Ollie will have people in mind and targets in mind, and the club will. But I think sometimes you have to reassure the people that they're looking at, the players. Do they want to move to a club who hasn't got a permanent manager? Maybe not. Maybe they were looking, saying, right, well, if Ollie does get the job, that makes it a bigger decision or a better decision or an easier decision. So I think it is the right thing. I think they've done it at the right time. And it also gives everybody else a bit of space to maybe think and rethink things as well.
Do you think there's a, not a risk, but I would imagine that when you're interim boss, you know, you come in and there's nothing to lose and the players respond to you because, you know, you're just a fresh face and frankly, you're not Jose Mourinho. Do you think there might be a little bit of a switch of mindset now as Solskjaer thinks, right, well, now I've got to actually start building for a longer term basis?
Yes, I think that's another thing for him to do. But I think as well, there's been, you know, one or two of the players saying, listen, we think he should get it. You know, we're certainly happy with him. He's a different type of manager. They've all sort of adhered to that, haven't they? They love him, which is great. And I think that maybe, you know, hearing that from some of the players may have put the board a little bit further forward in thinking, yes, we need to get him in situ. But I think it's just great for the football club. He knows the ethos of the Manchester United game. He's bringing the youth through. As you've already seen that. He's got that in him. He knows the football club. We've said this so many times. I think it's definitely the right decision.
Andy, my sort of worry with someone like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is he's clearly a lovely bloke and clearly gets on well with everyone and they all like him. But as a manager, you can't always be a player's friend. Now, you've worked with some of the best and most interesting managers, likes of Neil Warnock, Paul Hart as well. At what point do you have to turn around and say, sorry, mate, I like you, but actually I've got to be a bit authoritarian about this? And is it hard to do if you've spent 3 months being their mate?
Well, I don't think he has spent 3 months being the mate. You know, he's had to make some tough decisions. He's had to leave people out the side. Lukaku's been out. He's come back in and he's rejuvenated. You know, he's had to make those decisions. He knows. You've spoke to people, you know, like, you know, both the Nevilles have said he's got a ruthless streak. He had to have that as a player. I had to have it. I had to change when I was became a manager. And you learn off people and you have to make those decisions. That's why you're in the role. So I don't think there's a problem with that. I think he's also said he has got a type of hairdryer, maybe not as hot as Sir Alex's was, but he's got to be the authority there. But you can also, I feel, and I did it, you can mix it in. You know, be an amenable person. Don't walk around with your head down and be grumpy. And I think that's what's probably been a breath of fresh air to the players as well.
I also want to ask you, because I don't know if you know Mike Phelan at all, but you guys are similar ages and been around football for a similar amount of time. And I wonder, people talk a lot about his influence and the importance of him. I wonder if you could speak a little bit to how important he is and why he is such, it seems, a footballer whisperer.
Yeah, I do know Mike. I've known him for quite some time. I've played against him, obviously, quite a lot, especially when he was at Norwich. Mm. I think it was a master coup getting him back, because he knows the corridors of the football club. He's worked with the best manager in the world, Sir Alex Ferguson. He knows what he can pass on, and Ollie knew that as well. The information, the knowledge. He knew people within the football club, even though it has changed quite a bit since he left. But he knows people there, and it's a help to Ollie, who maybe didn't know some of the people around the place that had changed quite a bit since he had been there. So it was a masterstroke for me, and I think he has obviously did not just come out with the dots and the I's and crossing the T's with him, but I'm sure that he will be announced as well as part of the backroom staff. Ollie's going to be manager, and I'm sure he wants to keep the rest of those people, Kieran and Michael Carrick, with him as well.
Yeah, the dream team. Andy, thank you so much for your insight. Fascinating to have someone who knows the club and the people around the club so well. That's Andy Ritchie, former forward for Manchester United, and he's also, well, played for Brighton, Leeds, Oldham. He's been around football for a long time, and he knows exactly what's going on at United, which is that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been given a 3-year contract as a permanent manager at Manchester United, having been interim. It is worth pointing out, by the way, the people in the background at Manchester United, we all know Michael Carrick. We know who that is. We know Mike Phelan. And as Andy was alluding to there, we know he's an influential figure in football clubs. Worth pointing out as well, Kieran McKenna, a guy who had spent a couple of years as an under-18 coach at Manchester United, but he'd also been at Tottenham, and he had a lot of influence there at Tottenham. He wasn't there for a huge amount of time, maybe only there for a year and a half, I think, working with the under-18s, having also previously played there, but had a really key role in working with some of these players that have come through at Spurs. Don't underestimate how powerful Ole is with these men behind him. Mark Dempsey, Kieran McKenna, Mike Phelan, Michael Carrick. It's important. Football management is not a one-man job. You're a team.
This is Love Sport.
Now, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by a legend of the Football League next, talking about the race that is hotting up at the top of the Championship. Ian Holloway is on the line. Ian, it's great to have you. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you, James, and you?
Yeah, getting on well, mate. Now, I know that you are perhaps Marcelo Bielsa's biggest fan. I remember speaking to you just before the season started and how excited you were to see him in action. Has he been everything that you've dreamed of and more?
Yeah, apart from spying. I wasn't too happy with that. You know, he's too good to do that. But other than that, I think he's been sensational. Nothing other than sensational all season. So I will forgive him. But you know, there's some lines that you need to draw, and going and spying on set plays is a little bit over the top. But never mind. They've been sensational. I think he selected that club because of the new rules, the fair play rules and the crowd, and to prove himself like he's done, to give Leeds United supporters such a wonderful season, and also to not be undermined from above, and probably the first Leeds United manager for quite a while not to be undermined as he's doing his job. It has been brilliant. They don't deserve that. So, you know, they've still got a tough test. Will they get there? But it's been a fantastic season to be a Leeds United supporter, I'd imagine.
You mentioned that interference from above. It's probably something we talk about across clubs more than anything else. How difficult is it as a manager when you do have, for example, Paul Scholes at Oldham only lasted a month because he said he was basically having the team pick for him. How hard is it as a manager to actually turn around and say, look, mate, I'm the manager, I need to be able to do this myself? Or actually, do you just end up having to walk away sometimes?
Listen, it's not hard. It's just what you'll put up with to do the job. And, you know, that definitely a line that you cannot cross is having someone telling you what the team should be. Many an owner might try it, but more for them. You know, they're very successful in whatever business they do, but there's nothing like football. There's nothing like being on the coalface, seeing what the lads are training like, seeing how they're responding. You don't need to be told what to do, I can assure you. You know, so
do you pretty much have to turn around and say, look, mate, I know football, and you just had to be a strong will about that?
Yeah, I've also put it stronger than that at times, you know. you know, what are you paying me for, you know, if you want to do it yourself? But the difficulty is some of the owners are really, really successful people in other walks of life, and they like to hear the sound of their own voice, you know. But really, it's down to you and forging a relationship with them. You know, if you look at Pochettino, in the very, very top flight, how he gets on with Daniel Levy, you know, that's a great example of how well it can work if you're both on the same page. So, you know, it's something that you've got to learn. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have done it long enough now to not have anyone tell me what to do.
How impressed have you been with what Frank Lampard's done in his first season as a manager, obviously taking that job at Derby?
I've been very, very impressed with Frank. I always have been. I think he's a wonderful lad on and off the field. And he's a role model to millions of young lads of how you should behave. And I'm absolutely delighted to see his generation get their chance in management. And a very difficult club, because that club used to undermine its managers. Not deliberately, but by accident. And they want success so badly that, you know, you've got to find the Derby way of playing, you know. But really, I'm delighted to say that he's found a Frank Lampard way of playing. And, you know, if I was a player under someone like Frank, I would be inspired because of who he is and what he achieved in the game. I couldn't wait to listen to him.
Do you think there's a certain inevitability about a bloke like Frank doing very well in the Championship? The Chelsea job comes up every year or so. Are we going to see him on the touchline at Stamford Bridge in a blue blazer sooner rather than later, do you think?
Well, one day that'll be nice, but one day when they stop sacking managers so easily. You know, I think he doesn't deserve to be treated that way. And, you know, to be fair, I would say it's nothing short of amazing how Sarri has been treated this season, you know. And, you know, if they get a transfer embargo, Mr. Abramovich might have to stop how he's had success in the past and think about, hang on, what do we stand for here? What are we going to do here instead of sacking and sacking and sacking and sacking? It never works deep down, you know, never, ever works.
Do you think it's... I've often tried to propagate this theory and people have disagreed with me, but do you think it sort of creates this situation where a new manager comes in, the players go with him for a month or two, and then they realise they can get him sacked, so they stop believing in him? Do you think that happens at Chelsea?
Well, something's wrong with that squad because they underachieve with their performance levels, you know? In my opinion, they've got a couple of brilliant managers to sack, and that's my honest opinion. In Jose Mourinho and Conte. I can't believe it. But there you go. That's life. That's the way it is.
Absolutely.
And that's the way it works there. But, you know, at the end of the day, it shouldn't do.
I wanted to switch across West London briefly, Ollie, because I know QPR obviously is a club you know very, very well. And Steve McLaren's a very experienced manager. We sort of joke on the station that, you know, it's never worth predicting QPR results because they're so inconsistent this season. But what have you made of how they've done so far? Obviously, you know the squad very well.
Yeah, it's been a bit disappointing, you know, particularly the start of the season. I think they did ever so well to get over that so convincingly. Obviously, the first four games, you know, do we need to go back over that? No, you know, the club needed to get some senior players in. And they needed to do it a lot quicker for Steve than they did. So, you know, the young ones needed some guidance. I thought they made four great signings, in particularly Naki Wells, who is someone I've really liked for a long, long time. Very clever, very intelligent. You can build through him and play. And, you know, they picked up. But, you know, it's going to be tough for them, for not just last season, not just this season, in the couple of seasons coming, because of the fair play rules, you know, and that's it, and that's the truth, and unfortunately the owners won't be allowed to spend the money that they want to spend because of the rule changes. So you know, it's going to be a little bit tough, but the club's well worth fighting for, in my opinion, you know. And it's got a wonderful fan base, and unfortunately it's not got a big enough fan base to spend the money that they want to.
Yeah.
So, you know, and ironically, would that have happened years and years ago when Chelsea's ground was a lot smaller, you know?
Yeah.
And Abramovich, you know, so unfortunately, they probably took over QPR at the wrong time.
Yeah, quite. There's a lot of talk this week about the new stadium moving up to the Linford Christie. Will you be, much as obviously, as you mentioned, that's a huge thing for the club to move forward, but I would have thought you'd be extremely sad to see the back of Loftus Road.
Yeah, I think it's a very special place, a very special atmosphere. And, you know, I've been privileged to have played in that stadium and managed in it, you know, and I understand what that means. You know, I famously quoted it was our cave. We're not moving out of it, you know, because I felt that strongly when we were in administration. And luckily the supporters stuck with me in that time because things were tough. We weren't famous anymore. We did go through the hoop, through the ringer, and luckily I managed to talk a lot of young lads to take 25% of their wages to stop the club going bust back then. So, you know, I'm very proud of the football club. I'm very proud of where Les is trying to take it and what he wants to do with it. And I wish them all the very, very best. So, you know, whatever's best for them, and it isn't that far up the road, but it still wouldn't be the same, you know, because I remember Jerry Francis's family grooming me into being a QPR supporter, and luckily enough I managed to get there myself and understand what the wonderful club's all about.
Yeah, Ollie, it's always a pleasure talking to you. I could talk to you about QPR all day. Thank you very much for joining us, always a pleasure. That's Ian Holloway, of course, a QPR legend and an EFL expert. You can catch him on the EFL Highlights Show, which airs Saturday at 9 o'clock from this weekend on Sky, Virgin, Freeview, Freesat, online at questod.com, and of course via the Quest OD app.
This is Love Sport.
Always fascinating to hear from Ian Holloway, especially talking about QPR, a club clearly just love so much. I really hope that they get into that new stadium up at the Linford Christie. By the way, the Manchester United share price has gone up, as you might expect. Clears estate at 1958 is up to 1969 now, because Wall Street's just opened. Obviously, you all needed to know that. Speaking of finances in football, I just want to quickly tell you about a little bit of a... I guess it's something that's going to become a bigger issue, which is the top six in the Premier League basically going for a money grab. The financial chasm between the top six Premier League sides and the rest of the league could be heightened by leading clubs receiving up to £75 million more than the bottom sides in the Premier League's new overseas broadcasting rights agreement. Interesting story in the Telegraph today. Now, this already kind of happens this is to a certain extent in the Premier League, but also in Spain. Now, the difference in Spain is that Barcelona get €154 million in TV money. That was in 2017-18. Real Madrid get €148 million. Atletico get 110. And the next highest is Sevilla with 74. That is half of what Barcelona get. How on earth are these clubs supposed to break the hegemony of Barcelona and Real Madrid when their TV revenue, and let's face it, TV revenue is a big part of how much money you make, is 50% of what Barcelona are making? Now, the Premier League's overseas deal is worth about £4 billion. It's going to go over that figure, actually, for the first time ever over the next 3 years. They're getting close to finalising the deal for 2019 through to 2022. It's going up about a quarter, which is obviously a big boost after domestic rights went down. And the top six are saying, look, we're the big pull here. We're so much bigger than the other 14 teams in the Premier League. We should be getting more money. Now, at the moment, they do get a little bit more money because they're on TV more. You get a pro rata of about £1.5 million per game. But everyone still gets £80 million out of the pot, no matter where you finish in the Premier League. The top six are saying it should be more based on where they finish, get the TV money in line with prize money. For me, it's a massive money grab, and it's going to really affect the ability of the rest of the league to challenge. The reason we like the Premier League is because it's competitive week in, week out. We don't want to turn in La Liga, where Getafe can't realistically challenge for a long period of time. They're having the season of their lives, and they're nowhere near Barcelona or Real Madrid.
Love sports.
Frankly, I sort of think if anyone had turned up and said, hello, my name is not Jose Mourinho, that probably would have helped Manchester United bounce back from their dismal form under him. So, yes, he was a little bit lucky. The timing was excellent, but he's done the job asked of him, and I suppose in that sense, it deserved to be rewarded. Look, this was his dream job. He said, it's maybe strange and a little naive, but it's always been my dream to be Manchester United manager, and in that sense, he's got what he wanted. But he's not necessarily the most important signing Manchester United need to make. Clearly, having an actual manager in place, a permanent manager in place, is important and is useful to Manchester United for next season. Massively so, I suppose. But don't underestimate how important it is for the backroom staff to hang around as well. That list of names might not be spectacular. Michael Carrick, obviously a great player in his own right. Kieran McKenna, a guy who really only people know from the coaching world. Mike Phelan, you know, an extremely experienced man. Mark Dempsey as well, another lesser-known member of the Manchester United backroom staff. But it's very important to have a good group behind you when you're a manager. It's such a big job and such a hard job. You need that support. We spoke to former Manchester United forward Andy Ritchie earlier, a guy who's been a player, he's been a manager, he's been assistant to the likes of Neil Warnock, Paul Hart, and he knows Mike Phelan quite well. They're similar age, both grew up in the Northwest in footballing terms. And he told me what sort of influence he thinks that Phelan has had on Solskjaer.
It was a master coup getting him back because he knows the corridors of the football club. He's worked with the best manager in the world, Sir Alex Ferguson. He knows what he can pass on, and Ollie knew that as well. The information, the knowledge. He knew people within the football club, even though it has changed quite a bit since he left. But he knows people there, and it's a help to Ollie, who maybe didn't know some of the people around the place that had changed quite a bit since he had been there. So it was a master stroke for me.
That was Andy Ritchie talking to me about Mike Phelan. Of course, one of the first team coaches at Manchester United, a guy who knows the club inside out. He played for United. He was captain of United. And of course, he worked under Sir Alex Ferguson, one of the greatest managers of all time. Now, when David Moyes came in to replace Sir Alex Ferguson, he gutted the back room, presumably in an effort to ensure that he had like a fresh start, that he didn't have trouble stamping his authority because he wasn't Fergie. Anyone who replaced Fergie was always going to have to try not to be Fergie, because if they're just too big boots to fill. Interesting, actually, that 2 years later, Fergie himself accused Moyes of, quote, trying to display his manhood, whatever that means. I don't think he actually got it out, but I think sort of metaphorically. I think what he actually meant was, softly, softly, catchy monkey is a pretty decent approach at Manchester United. It's a club where any new manager had to, and so many people said this, quote, understand the DNA of the club. I think that phrase just needs undressing a little bit because it sort of feels euphemistic. What does it actually mean? Well, I think what it means is that as much as players might change, a lot of the workings of the football club stay the same over the same period of time, especially over a period of success. And if you come in and disrupt that, you risk upsetting a very delicate equilibrium of an organisation. I'll tell you something interesting, right? Google have spent a lot of time and money investigating what makes a good team. Not what makes a good football team, what makes a good team of humans working together. They recognise that when you get the right group of people in a room or on a floor or wherever, when you get the right group of people, they create something that is greater than the sum of its parts. So in a very Google way, they plugged a load of money and a load of data and a load of resources into testing what works best. So they spent 2 years on something called Project Aristotle, which sounds like something out of a Bond film. But they were trying to codify the secrets of team effectiveness. Now, they went in with the idea that the way to build the best team is get the best people at the jobs and put them together, which makes sense, right? If you want to have the best radio show, you get a good producer. I've never been able to find one. I just got Ben. You get a decent presenter, someone better than me. And that's how you have the best radio show. But no, Ben and I are not the two best people at our jobs in the world. And we know that. But we're the best team in the world, Ben. You see, I've recovered it. He's smiling now. Oh, little fist, his little face. I wish you could see it. But this is the point. Google thought you had to get the best people in the building to create the best team. But simply, it's not the case. Equally, they found that there's actually no simple formula. Sometimes you need people with shared experience. Sometimes with diverse experiences. They couldn't actually fathom why some teams worked and why some didn't. They really found all they could find was some characteristics that were sort of common in successful teams. Dependability, structure, clarity, impact, team members knowing that they have an impact. But they couldn't identify exactly how to create these things. Perhaps the most important thing they saw, though, was that psychological safety was the single most important factor in team effectiveness. Now, that's interesting, isn't it? Psychological safety, i.e. knowing that you can stand up in a meeting and say, I've got this idea, do you think this will work, without fear of retribution or criticism or looking like an idiot. And that's the same on the football pitch. You need a situation where players feel they can do things and try things without fear that they're doing it wrong. Look at United's last three managers, right? Full-time managers, that is. David Moyes came in and got rid of people before even allowing them much of a chance to prove their worth. He got rid of all the backroom staff. He admitted later he regretted that move. Louis van Gaal became so obsessed with the idea that the media were trying to get rid of him that he got entrenched in his own tactics, in a tactic that saw his team make the most backwards passes in the league in his final season. Incidentally, more than 3,000 backwards passes in a season. Yeah, no wonder Old Trafford fans. You ever seen that video of that bloke falling asleep at Old Trafford? That was under Louis van Gaal, and I don't blame him. You can see how little that he listened to other people. You know, even he had Ryan Giggs behind him, and he never listened to him, really. You can see in that interview earlier this week when he claimed that no one liked his, quote, boring attacking football. That people just saw what they want to see, that Solskjaer parked the bus just like Jose Mourinho did. That it's so single-minded, it refuses to think, oh, maybe if I listen to the bloke behind me, like Kieran McKenna, like Mike Phelan, like Michael Carrick. The players under Van Gaal lacked any spontaneity. And actually, reading an article written at the time of his sacking, they were gripped by the fear of attempting the unexpected. Does that sound familiar at all? Jose Mourinho's Manchester United created this system where the players were afraid of trying something new. It's not an environment in which creative talent, and remember that football is a creative sport. It's a sport which is very, very unstructured. In order to succeed at it, you need to be structured in defence, but in attack, you have to be unstructured to break down the other team. And when you have this environment where players don't feel they can express themselves, they don't feel they're supported by the people above and below them, it doesn't work. It's not an environment where creative talent can thrive. Solskjaer is very different. He's a popular figure, and he's one whom the players trust and respect. He will take their views on board, and he will work with them. Not on them, he'll work with them to get better.
This is Love Sport.
Let's speak to Leo Niebuhr, news writer and social media editor for The People's Person. Leo, is this the right man at the right time?
I would say definitely the right man, but I would probably say not the right time. And I'll give you that reason why, because it's more interesting. I think the fact that United have chosen to appoint him now, in this international break, sort of demonstrates that they are already looking towards the summer, they're looking towards the future. And what that really means is that this positivity that has been engendered by Solskjaer over the last few months, which has deservedly got him the job, I think what United are seeing at the top, the Chiefs think, we can just keep this positivity going. We don't need to make any real fundamental changes. I think, you know, they see how Solskjaer is engaged with the players. They've obviously seen that he's won 14 games out of 19 and thought, you know, we've found an answer. We've stumbled upon something of an answer. My feeling, though, beyond that, really, is that because of that, United have shirked this responsibility that they've had and that United fans have demanded of them to hire a director of football and to get a proper structure in behind Solskjaer. That has always been the aim. And I think the fact that they've done it now, as Miguel Delaney from The Independent said, shows that that is a result of them not having a director of football. If they did have someone behind the scenes who was really in charge of the long-term planning for United, maybe they would have been able to wait a bit longer to announce Solskjaer. But as it is, it looks like they've shirked that responsibility. And to me, and this is a negative thing to say on a positive day for United, but my feeling is that it doesn't matter who's in charge of United. If that structure isn't in place, that good structure isn't in place, the one that Spurs have, the one that Liverpool has, the one that Arsenal is growing now, any manager, doesn't matter who they are going to fail long term. So to me, although this is a great day and I'm delighted for Solskjaer, I think that is a worry that United fans have to have, and it's something that we need to keep talking about, because I think it could trip United and it could trip Solskjaer up in the long term.
What, just finally, Leo, what are the signings that United fans want to see this season? I appreciate that you want to see a strategy, you want to see things go the right way, but there must be a couple of players you've got an eye on thinking, God, I'd kill for him to be here next year.
There are, and I always find it hard to talk about potential players and signings because it's so speculative. But one thing that I wholeheartedly would love to see is a real investment in a central defensive partner for Victor Lindelof. If I had to give you a name, it would be Kalidou Koulibaly, because he's been so good for Napoli for so many years. He only jumped on the scene last year, but he's been great for a while. Another example would be a new right back, somebody who can partner with Diego Dalot. Somebody with a bit more experience. A player of a Dani Alves mould, I would say. Maybe someone who isn't going to play most of the games, but somebody who has that personality. Someone who can sort of match that personality of Ashley Young, but with a bit more ability. Mm. You know, you add on top of that, you know, these, if you looked on Twitter, if you spoke to United fans, these would be secondary concerns. The two big names are Sancho and Hudson-Odoi. And those two are extremely exciting players. And for me, the former, Sancho especially. If United could pull that off in the summer, with Mata going moving away from Old Trafford, then that would be a huge appointment. But to me, names aren't really important. I think what United and what a director of football should be doing, if we have one at the club, is to be looking for a particular profile of player. Somebody who you can see fitting into the team, into that specific group for a long time. Like if you look at Spurs, for example, they haven't signed many players, but they've signed the right ones.
This is Love Sport.
Now, you will have heard it yesterday, Gordon Taylor agreeing to step down from his role as chief executive of the PFA eventually. One of the big bugbears that a lot of people criticise Taylor for failing to do is put proper money and proper research into the links between football and dementia. Now, one person who has first-hand experience of this is Rachel Taylor, whose father Rod played for Portsmouth, Gillingham, Bournemouth, a South Coast legend, you might call him. Rachel, why don't you tell me a little bit about your dad? And he passed away, sadly, last year, we know, but he obviously, he suffered at the hands of the lack of funding into dementia. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's, we lost him coming up for a year, and his demise was pretty harrowing. And, you know, we, if it wasn't for the likes of Dawn Astor supporting our family, I don't know how we would have got through it, actually. It was devastating.
Did you find that you got any support? I mean, of course, what people maybe forget about the PFA, it's not just an organisation that looks after current footballers. It's supposed to look after footballers all the way through their lives. Did you receive any support at all from them?
We received a booklet from regarding activities such as walking football and memory clubs. But when somebody's in the end stages of dementia, they don't even know their own daughter, you know. And
I understand that's obviously extremely hard. Do you think that there has, even over the last couple of years, been a greater awareness within the Professional Football Association of what they should be doing, that they should be doing things?
Oh, they're aware. They're absolutely aware. I mean, they've, you know, Jeff Astor died in 2002 and the coroner ruled it as an industrial injury.
Wow.
You know, and then they started a study and then they stopped the study and then they've just started another study with Dr. Stewart at the beginning of the year, at the field study. And I'm hoping that the results, hopefully sometime this year, will come out that, you know, we as families don't need data, stats, whatever, to prove what we already know. We know that our fathers have suffered and died because they played football. This is not, you know, people say, oh, you know, my granny never headed a ball and, you know, she got dementia. This is a very particular type of dementia, CTE, and in my dad's case, he had CTE and dementia with Lewy bodies, both of which are linked to collision sports. So we don't, whilst these scientists and this, you know, the important work they're doing is important, we as families, you know, the boots on the ground know by just looking at our you know, parent that they are suffering and they're suffering because they played football. So do the PFA know? Have they known? Yeah, they do. And that's the reason why in the last couple of weeks, I just despair, I really do. In the last couple of weeks, there's been some really serious head collisions with the Napoli goalie, Ospina and Fabian Scher.
Yeah.
You know, and the PFA will tweet about player of the month and, you know, where you can get your free, you know, Mercedes-Benz and all this kind of stuff on Twitter and their websites. And they've not made any comment on two serious head collisions. I mean, why is that? And the reason is because it's the elephant in the room.
Do you have any sort of optimism that with Gordon Taylor stepping down, that might change?
I mean, I was talking to Dawn yesterday when the news broke, actually, and the relief. I mean, we were both in tears. The relief is just huge because there's hopefully hope now for the families going forward that are in this predicament. Too late for me, too late for Dawn Astor, you know, our dads are gone. But there was relief. And then when you start to read into the detail, I got a bit alarmed, actually. Last night I was reading more, I was looking at the press releases on the PFA site, and it's, you know, I mean, Ben Perkis, you know, the chief antagonist, he's going. I mean, why is he going? I mean, you know, and the management committee, they're going. I mean, the management committee is not the same as the management team, the people that prop up Gordon Taylor, you know, the likes of John Bramall. You know, they're not, as far as I know, they're not going. So that they're getting rid of Ben and they're getting rid of the management committee, which are all fairly sort of, you know, they're not the high echelons of the PFA. They're all going. They're all falling on the sword. But, you know, the people that are behind Gordon and, you know, are they going to be able to apply for his position? That's what Dawn and myself and other families are worried, that somebody is exactly the same ilk as Gordon Taylor is just going to step into those boots.
Those valid concerns. Rachel, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're a very, very busy woman, but that's Rachel Taylor, whose father Rod sadly passed away, suffered with end-stage dementia, and she firmly believes that part of that demise was due to his career as a footballer. He played for Portsmouth, Gillingham, Bournemouth, and the PFA have been widely criticised for their failure to acknowledge the link between football and CTE, which is something that the NFL have recently done. in a huge class action lawsuit, and football has still failed to acknowledge it.
Love sports.
Of course, we're talking about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer because he today has been given a 3-year contract as full-time permanent manager of Manchester United, the club, of course, where he scored 126 goals in 366 appearances. They owe it to him, don't they? They owe it to him to treat him properly and, you know, give him the job that he deserves. He says it's a special club. I felt at home from the first day I arrived. It was an honour to be a player and then to start my coaching career. The last few months have been fantastic. I mean, what a guy. Brilliant, brilliant bloke. The players love him. And that, of course, is part of the attraction for the board. He is the player's manager. And this is what makes him an obvious appointment for United, frankly, who, remember, have a squad that's teetering on the edge of falling apart. And when I say that, I mean, David De Gea, Ander Herrera, Juan Mata, they could all walk away from Manchester United, where they've got contracts that are expiring. Paul Pogba's agent, Mino Raiola, charlatan that he is, keeps insisting on linking him to a move away. And obviously the defensive frailties are clear for everyone to see. There's a lot of things wrong with this squad, most of which are going to need to be solved by a man with a pen and a long contract and a very big checkbook. But the problem is, it's very hard to sign players, either from outside or inside, when you don't have guarantees that you can make them. There's no guarantee they'll be playing in the Champions League next season. There's no guarantee they'll reach the heights of the Ferguson era, and they certainly haven't since he left. There's no guarantee, or at least there wasn't until today, that they'd have the same manager in charge. So, for all the Manchester United are still a big name, he's still a hard sell. They're likely to have a really busy summer, actually, and an expensive summer as well, by the way, which, if they have any sense, they will have already started making moves, negotiations, sounding people out. And that will be made a great deal easier by having a popular and permanent manager in place. It's not a perfect situation, but from a negotiation perspective, it's hugely improved for United. So he's also a club man. He's a player's manager and he's a club manager. He's not been shy about it being his dream and always has been. And in that sense, the club appear to have given him what he wants. But isn't he just a pawn here? Isn't he just a pawn in a grand old game of chess where Manchester United have got much bigger fish to fry? Isn't he just a stopgap, basically? While United start to get their ducks in a row, they haven't got a director of football, they didn't have a manager, they haven't got a centre-half, they haven't got a right-back, they haven't even got their best player, David De Gea, signed into a new contract. So they thought, well, you know what? Let's put the cart before the horse, shall we? Let's put Solskjaer there, then we get the manager in, everyone likes him. So that's a popular decision. It'll stop people saying, why haven't you got a director of football? Why haven't you got a manager? Why haven't you signed a right back? Why haven't you nailed down David De Gea's contract? It's something, it's an easy win for them. And I think it's disingenuous. This 3-year contract, Betfred are offering odds of 7-4 that he doesn't see out his 3-year Manchester United contract. I think it's much, much shorter than that. I don't think there's any hope in hell that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer sees out his three-year contract at Manchester United. What manager does? What manager actually gets to the end of their contract these days and doesn't get the sack halfway through? Especially United, you know, which is becoming a bit of a curate's egg of a club, let's face it. It's not easy. So I think they've just seen an easy win. Said, right, we'll give him the contract and that'll make our lives a little bit easier when we start sitting down and trying to sign some players. Because, frankly, look how hard it was for Chelsea to make big signings when Antonio Conte wouldn't go, or they couldn't get rid of him or something. I think legally we're still not allowed to know exactly what happened there. But it took them a long time to get Sarri under the table, and he wasn't able to make the signings. He got Jorginho, his best mate, but frankly wasn't able to make the kind of big signings that Chelsea needed. What about Real Madrid? Look who they signed over January. Brahim Diaz. I mean, really? I don't think that was the massive La Liga season-saving signing that they needed in January. And why would you go to Madrid? Obviously, it's still a pull. But why would you go when Santiago Solari's in charge? You don't know how long he's going to last. And frankly, he's not looking in that good nick anyway. So there's absolutely no reason why you would sign for Real Madrid, other than it's Real Madrid, obviously. If you're Florentino Perez sitting in a meeting, say, and they say, oh, who's going to be the boss? He's going to go, well, yes, yeah, Solari. But you can't believe him. You can't believe him when he says that. It would be almost a lie to say that it would be. So I feel like Manchester United have played a clever move here. But I worry, what if Ole Gunnar Solskjaer 10 games into next season, has won two of them. And all of a sudden, all this good feeling, all this goodwill, a squad that went to pieces very quickly under Mourinho and was then healed very quickly under Solskjaer could go to pieces all over again. And while Manchester United have talked about how important Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is to this club, how he's part of the DNA, and how he's going to take them to where they need to be to build the next stage of their history, Woodward's words, not mine, they can say all of that as much as they like. But the reality is, his position is no more cemented than it was before.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.